This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting today from the Knight Studio at The Newseum, Washington, D.C.'s newest museum devoted to journalism and the news business. Just three more primaries left. The Democratic Party finally decides what to do with results from Florida and Michigan. Senator Clinton invokes the RFK assassination, and Senator John McCain does some grilling of potential running mates at his vacation home in Sedona, Arizona. It's time for yet another edition of The Political Junkie.
There you go again.
My name is Geraldine Ferraro.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
I'm John Kerry, and I'm reporting for duty.
But I'm the decider.
NPR political editor Ken Rudin brings us up to date on Puerto Rico, Montana, and South Dakota, and the Democratic National Committee Rules Committee meeting scheduled for this weekend. Won't that be exciting? Rare agreement from all three major presidential candidates. The Libertarians pick their nominee. We'll focus today on how presidential candidates choose their running mates, geography, ideology, congeniality, and later in the program, the confessions of a White House press secretary. But as usual, we'll begin with a trivia question. Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, is here with us at the Newseum. Ken, hello. Oh, and what's the trivia question?
Hello, Neil. Well, we heard in that introduction, we heard Geraldine Ferraro accepting the vice presidential nomination in 1984 in San Francisco. She was the last sitting incumbent member of the House to be named running mate. We're going to be talking about running mates this hour. Who, prior to Geraldine Ferraro, who was the last member of the House named to the ticket?
Sitting member, incumbent member of the House of Representatives who ran on the ticket for president or vice
major
president.
Major party ticket, right.
All right. If you think you know the answer, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. We'll also, of course, accept guesses from members of the audience here at the Newseum. And you can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. So how many down? Three left to go.
Three left to go, Puerto Rico on Sunday, and then Montana and South Dakota on Tuesday. June 3rd.
Why Sunday in Puerto Rico?
Because that's the way they do it. Look, the fact that we're still talking about primaries in June shows how remarkable this race is, the closest in memory.
We also have, and we'll get into more depth on this a little later, but got a lot of speculation about vice presidential candidates, especially on the Republican side. Senator McCain had a little barbecue in Arizona this weekend.
He did. He invited three names who have been on this short list. This short list is not that short. Basically, John McCain's criteria is anybody younger than he is, and he'll be 72 in August, so it's going to be a huge list. But actually, you know, we always make fun of the vice presidential decision and whether it's really important or not. We talked about how, you know, great John Edwards was named to the ticket, and yet not only did he not help the Kerry ticket, Kerry, North Carolina, not a single state in the South was won by the Democrats in 2004. We made a big Geraldine Ferraro again, who we heard before was, you know, very exciting, the first female vice presidential nominee on a major party ticket, and yet the Mondale Ferraro ticket lost 49 states in 1984. And for all the jokes made about Dan Quayle and in 1988, Bush Quayle won 40 out of 50 states against the Dukakis ticket. So for all the focus we do on the vice presidential running mate, ultimately, it doesn't always mean that much, but sometimes it does.
And do we know that those people who were down there at the barbecue, and they included Mitt Romney and Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana.
And Charlie Crist, the governor of Florida.
And are they really on the short list? Have you seen a short list?
They are. I mean, they're the people, you know, obviously they'll either bring states, they'll bring compatibility, they'll bring kind of balance. Like, for example, my pick, I said on the air not too long ago, was Rob Portman, the former Ohio congressman, for the Bush budget director, and the reason I thought he'd be a good choice is, one, he's a good campaigner, two, he's from Ohio, three, he brings to the ticket what John McCain lacks, and that is focusing and knowledge about budgetary issues, economic issues.
And the economy, former trade representative as well.
Right,
so.
Right.
Anyway, we have some people on the line who think they know the answer to today's trivia question. Let's begin with Paul. Paul's with us from Nag's Head in Massachusetts.
Nag's Head, North Carolina.
Oh, excuse me. Never had. Go ahead.
I thought the answer was Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Lyndon Baines Johnson was a member of Congress.
Well, actually, he was a Senate Majority Leader when JFK picked him in 1960, but he was a member of the House. And we're looking for somebody who, at the time of being picked for the ticket, was a member of the House of Representatives.
Nice try, Paul.
Thanks. You have a good day.
You too. Let's see if we can go to... Let's go to Patrick. Patrick with us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
Good. Harry S. Truman.
Harry S. Truman of Missouri.
Never a member of the House. He was a senator from Missouri when, as you well remember, FDR dumped Henry Wallace at the 1944 convention, named Harry Truman running mate. But again, he was a senator, not a member of the House.
FDR didn't like his vice presidents, did he? Nice try, Patrick.
No, but FDR was named after that highway in New York,
yeah,
which is kind of ironic.
It's a drive. Let's see if we can get... keep pushing the wrong button. Alan's on the line. Alan with us from Boise in Idaho.
Was it William Miller, Barry Goldwater's running mate?
That is correct. And, you know, we talk about the correct answer. And what's fun about that is we always think of why people name people to the ticket. You know, obviously Ferraro to help with the gender gap against Reagan in 84. Barry Goldwater said the reason he picked Bill Miller is because he drives LBJ nuts. And that was the reason. And they carried six states that year. But Miller obviously was not a factor in the decision.
Picked Bill Miller because he thought he would star in a Miller Lite commercial saying, who am I, 20 years afterwards?
Actually, that's exactly what he did. Right?
He did, yes,
right,
indeed. Right. Yeah. Thanks very much, Alan. Congratulations. You get this week's no prize.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye. Let's see if we can talk about the Rules Committee meeting this weekend. Is this going to finally determine what the Democrats do with the delegates from Michigan and Florida? Of course, those two states voted out of order. They moved up to think that they would have been important. Of course, they would have been really important if they'd stayed where they were. But nevertheless, they were punished by being stripped of their delegates.
Neil, what was your question? No, the question is, will it be the final decision? I think it may not, because, first of all, there are 30 members of the Rules Committee. They are meeting in Washington on Saturday, obviously, what to do with Michigan and Florida. At the time, the Rules Committee decided, they voted, to punish both states. Initially, they want to strip 50% of the delegates, and they wound up stripping 100% of the delegates away. But all the Clinton representatives on the Rules Committee voted for this rule when it first came out. The controversy didn't happen until Hillary Clinton wound up winning Michigan and Florida without opposition. I mean, nobody was on the ballot in Michigan, and, of course, nobody campaigned in either state.
Dennis Kucinich was on the ballot in Michigan.
And Chris Dodd, exactly. But Hillary Clinton won like 55% of the vote in Michigan. Uncommitted got like about 40%. The question is, what do you do with these delegates? But at the time, the Rules Committee, which included Harold Dickies, who's a big Hillary Clinton supporter, who included Hillary Clinton personnel, all agreed that both states should be punished. Now that Hillary Clinton is behind in the delegates, behind the, obviously fighting for her life for the Democratic nomination, she is now saying that these should be her delegates. So there's a big fight on Saturday. If the Obama people are saying, look, we will concede that Hillary Clinton deserves more because, after all, she did win more of the votes, whether they mattered or not, she did win more of the votes. And she also, if the Obama campaign feels that they're strong enough in a position that they have the nomination well in hand, why not be magnanimous enough to at least have some unity in the party? Because obviously they're going to have to get the Clinton and Obama wings together after it happens. Well, so, but if there's no resolution, then the Clinton people can go to the Credentials Committee in July to fight for that. And if the Credentials Committee has a different decision, then the full Democratic convention in August in Denver will have to vote. We'll have to ratify. This is all one sentence.
I know.
Yes. We'll have to ratify the decision of the Credentials Committee. The last thing the Democratic Party wants is a battle that goes all the way to the convention in August. They want it resolved this weekend.
What was the question again?
Exactly.
You reminded me earlier today of a clip of tape. In October, Senator Clinton appeared on a show called The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio, where she said she didn't think it would make any difference whether or not her name would stay on the ballot in the state of Michigan. The host of that program, our former colleague Laura Kanoy, asked her why in that case she just didn't take her name off the ballot in Michigan.
People in Michigan are flat on their backs. I mean, they have the highest unemployment rate in America. They are now grappling finally with what they're going to do about the auto industry. 1 in 10 jobs in America is tied to the auto industry, which is, the American auto industry, which, as we know, is centered in Michigan. You know, it's clear this election they're having is not going to count for anything.
Not going to count for anything until I win it.
Well, until I need these delegates to move into contention for the nomination.
All right.
That's basically what it is.
A couple of items on YouTube made a lot of headlines this past week. Senator Clinton invoked the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. Again, asked why she was staying in the race. She said, well, my husband didn't wrap up his nomination until June. And we remember that Senator Kennedy was assassinated in June.
Well, it was obviously a poor analogy. She regretted it immediately and apologized immediately. I think what she was trying to say is that the nomination should be not over until every state has its say. Obviously, 1968, things were much different. The person who won the nomination didn't even compete in the primaries, and that was Hubert Humphrey, didn't compete in a single primary. The nomination back then started in March in New Hampshire, ended in California tragically with Robert Kennedy's assassination. But obviously, she was trying to make the point that obviously it's not over until it's over, and things can happen. Unfortunately, it was not the most not the best comparison she could have come up with.
And we mentioned just three primaries left in presidential primaries. There's a vote in New Jersey coming up.
Well, there's some big primaries on Tuesday. One just in New Mexico. Pete Domenici is retiring after 2,000 years in the Senate. Democrats have a good shot of winning that. Actually, Domenici's been in the Senate since 1973, the longest in New Mexico history. All three members of the House in New Mexico are running for the Senate there. In New Jersey, Frank Lautenberg, who's 84 years old, is being challenged by a young congressman, Rob Andrews. When Frank Lautenberg was first elected to the Senate in 1982, he criticized his Republican opponent, Millicent Fenwick, for being too old. He didn't say she was too old, but he made fun of her age. She was 72 at the time. Here is Frank Lautenberg, now 84 years old, being really the issue against him is the fact that he may be too old and too out of touch, but he should win handily because he has the whole Democratic establishment behind him.
One other item of interest this week, all three of the major presidential candidates, Senators McCain, Obama, and Clinton, reached agreement and issued a statement, joint statement, on Darfur, which it's nice that they agree on something.
I think they're all three came out against genocide, which was a good, it's a very nice
thing. We like them to be against
that. It's a hopeful thing, because there are not many candidates are for it. But no, seriously, I mean, they all signed on to a New York Times full-page ad criticizing the government, talking about the genocide and what they plan to do when any of them are president. It's a hopeful sign, and perhaps it could lead to some other agreements, but it's unlikely.
It's Veep time. That's the bottom of the ticket. But at the top of the candidates' minds, when we come back, we'll talk about how you make and vet a running mate list with Ron Klain. He put such a list together for Vice President Al Gore back in 2000. We're live at the Knight Studio at the Newseum here in Washington, D.C., 800-989-8255. If you have questions about how you go about selecting a vice president, you can also send us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, and we broadcast Wednesdays from the Knight Studio inside the Newseum in Washington, D.C. It's Political Junkie Day, of course, and Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor, is with us as we wend our way to the conventions ever so slowly. The candidates quietly begin to compile lists of possible running mates. We want to know what you think. What does the choice of a running mate tell you about the presidential candidate? If you have a question about how presidential candidates pick their running mates, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. Ron Klain was chief of staff to Vice President Al Gore. In that capacity, he was heavily involved in the vetting process that resulted in Senator Joe Lieberman becoming the vice presidential candidate, and he's with us today. Members of the studio audience might notice he bears a striking resemblance to Kevin Spacey. He's going to have to get used to these jokes. Kevin Spacey played him in the HBO movie Recount, which was on TV Sunday and again on Monday night. And Ron Klain, nice to have you here on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me, Neil, and I'd like to point out I do have more hair than Kevin Spacey.
Very wavy hair, too.
Thank you very much.
There you go. Let me ask you, how do you go about, once you think your man has got the nomination, how do you go about assembling a list?
Or woman.
Has the nomination. How do you go about assembling that list?
Well, it's a process that's shrouded with a lot of mystery and intrigue and whatnot. But at core, it's a process that's not unfamiliar to anyone in America who's ever applied for a job or run a job search. You start off with a longer list of candidates. You go through a series of steps to narrow that list down. You conduct some interviews. And then in the end, through some combination of mystery and merits and chemistry and all these things, someone finally gets the job and a lot of other people don't. And, there are various steps along the way, but really it's no different than any other job search than anyone else runs in the country at some level.
Right, with the exception that there's a lot of public interest in it.
Yes, obviously, it's a very high-stakes job search, and it's important to get it right. And that's why a lot of what goes into picking a vice president is both finding the right person and also making sure you don't find the wrong one. We know that there are some catastrophic examples of vice presidential searching, the Eagleton search in 1972 being the most famous example, and I think a little less catastrophically, the process by which then Vice President Bush picked Dan Quayle to be his running mate in 1992. Also did not serve him very well. So I think you're both looking to make a good pick and not make a bad pick and do both at the same time.
You mentioned Tom Eagleton, then senator from Missouri, who I guess a few days after the convention, he was found to have had shock therapy, and that was a big deal. And he had to, after the candidate, George McGovern, said he was behind him 1,000%, he pulled the plug on him and replaced him on the ticket.
Right, and that gets to kind of vetting rule number one, which is what we call the no surprises rule. I think what you're looking for, if you're one of the staff people who is running this process on behalf of your candidate, is to make sure that you find everything you should know, everything you need to know about the potential vice presidential candidate. You're bringing that to the attention of the nominee and letting that person weigh all those factors. There are no perfect people, and there are no unblemished people. This is a search run by people of human beings who all have their pros and cons. The important thing isn't to find the perfect no problems candidates, to find someone and identify what all those issues are and let the prospective nominee make an informed choice about who his or her running mate will be.
Ken?
Ron, you talk about the disastrous pick of Dan Quayle, and yet Bush Quayle did win 40 states in 1988, and everybody talks about how great or exciting the John Edwards pick was, and yet he didn't help the ticket win anywhere in the South. So ultimately, the decision is really about the presidential candidate. Do we agree with that?
I do, Ken. I mean, I say this as someone who worked for vice presidents, spent a lot of time working for vice presidents and helping pick two vice presidents. But in the end, I don't really think the vice presidential choice winds up being that big a part of voters' choices in the fall. I think it's an important choice for two reasons. First, it tells you something about the presidential candidate themselves. How that person goes about picking who they pick is one of the factors I think voters weigh in their minds. It's the first example of a presidential-caliber decision that someone's going to have to make. And secondly, I think from the perspective of the candidates, I think they take this choice very seriously. They know they are picking someone, unfortunately, who may well become president of the United States, on a heartbeat's notice. And so I think it's a very important choice that way, because we know throughout our history, sadly and tragically, a certain number of these people wind up being president of the United States, and therefore it's a very important choice for that reason.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. This is Tyson. Tyson with us from Overland Park in Kansas.
Hello.
Go ahead, please.
The comment I had was that in regards to the race that's happening before us, I think the candidates are trying to pick a vice presidential candidate just based on the sole fact that they need to pick up votes from other populations in the country. You go through the race, and there's so many great vice presidential candidates that could be picked, but they're cast aside because they don't fill a certain void that these candidates can't fill at the moment.
Do you pick a vice president who you think could help you get elected, or do you pick a vice president who you think could help you govern?
Well, I think a bit of both. I think a bit of both, Neil. But I do think that what the caller's raising is this traditional idea of ticket balancing, and I think we've seen less of that in recent years. Most famously, I think in 1992, when President Clinton, then Governor Clinton of Arkansas, defied every single rule of ticket balancing that political junkies knew about. You should pick, if you're young, pick someone old. If you're from one part of the country, pick someone from the other part of the country. If you're from one wing of the party, pick someone from the other wing of the party. He picked someone who was from the state next to his, who's the exact same age as he was, and from the exact same wing of the party he was when he picked Al Gore, and made a statement that way. And certainly, then Governor Bush picked now Vice President Cheney from the state of Wyoming. I don't think it was to deliver Wyoming's three electoral votes. And I think, as Ken just pointed out, the rationale for picking John Edwards wasn't really to deliver North Carolina. He didn't deliver North Carolina. So I think that people think about this ticket balancing thing a lot more than the candidates do. I think candidates are really looking for someone who can help their overall cause in the campaign, who can be a good partner in governing, and who could be a good president if they had to step up to do that job.
Thanks very much for the call, Tyson.
Thank you.
Let's see if we can go now to Kathy. And Kathy's with us from Howell in Michigan.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call and giving me my Wednesday political junkie fix.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Hillary supporter and have bantered back and forth with Ken a couple times by email.
Uh-oh.
But I'm a Democrat. I mean, regardless of whether Obama takes it. However, I have a number of friends and family who will vote for McCain if the vice presidential choice is right like Chris from Florida. Is McCain likely to be able to find a VP who will pander to his base enough and still to the disenfranchised Democrats at the same time?
That's the other party, Ron, but we'd appreciate your thoughts.
Well, look, I think that both Senator Obama and Senator McCain face the classic choice between a vice presidential running mate who excites their base on the one hand and one who appeals to swing voters on the other hand. And I think that much more than geography or age or resume, traversing that line is the hardest political aspect of the choice that both have to make. In the case of Senator McCain, I think he's obviously tried very hard to distance himself from President Bush as much as he can, to show some independence from the more conservative elements of his party. And this is another fork in the road for him on that choice. Is he going to appeal to the more conservative elements of the party? Is he going to try to go to the middle of the road? I don't think really anyone but John McCain knows where he'll come out on that.
Thanks for the call, Kathy. And Ken said to say he's sorry.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye. Let's get a question from here in the audience at the museum.
Hi, my name is Julia Moss. I'm from Washington, D.C. There was a lot of talk originally about Obama and Clinton on the same ticket, that magic ticket, but that seems to be increasingly unlikely. And what would be another possible kind of dream ticket that either that would get Clinton supporters to go to Obama or vice versa, getting Obama supporters to go to Clinton? So what would be that?
Well, first of all, I think it's too soon to rule out the idea that Senator Obama and Senator Clinton might run together. And right now that would look, if you look at the current delegate count, a lot more like Senator Obama as the presidential nominee and Senator Clinton as the vice presidential nominee. I think that's entirely possible. It's the last time a Democrat picked John Kerry, he did pick the runner-up in the contest, John Edwards, and very often that is the way it works out. That said, I think if not these two people coming together, it wouldn't surprise me if the person who won the nomination wound up picking someone who had been a primary supporter of the other candidate to show an effort to unify the party and bring people together. I think that in the end, while there's obviously a lot of passion around the Clinton-Obama thing inside the Democratic Party right now, they both come from relatively similar ideological point of view. The differences between either of them and Senator McCain are very dramatic. And so I think our party is going to come together when this is all over, no matter which one of the two is nominated. I don't think that healing that rift will be a major part of the vice presidential selection process, but it'll be part of the process.
And just like John McCain has that same balancing act he has to do, Obama has the same thing, whether he reaches out to perhaps a female running mate like Kathleen Sebelius, the governor of Kansas, perhaps Janet Napolitano, the governor of Arizona, or he goes out after a Hillary Clinton supporter like perhaps Governor Ted Strickland of Ohio, who could perhaps theoretically bring in a very important a state in the Midwest like Ohio. So he has that same kind of balancing act to do.
But Ron Klain, let me ask you, as you're getting down to the shortlist, is there any benefit to leaking some of those names so that you find out various reactions to them, or even if you placate one wing of the party, say, well, at least we're, Senator Obama is considering Pat Buchanan, so the conservative wing of the Democrats will be happy.
Yeah, probably not so much Pat Buchanan, but no, Neil, I think it's a great point, and it's a very interesting thing in this process. The candidates all make a big deal about how secretive the process is, but I will also say every single time they make sure to leak a list of finalists, and I think you've got it right on the head here. I think they do it for two reasons. First of all, it gives a little chance to see, well, what's the reaction to these potential picks? It's a little bit of a trial balloon syndrome. Well, these are the three names that are out there. What do people say about them? And secondly, it does provide a certain amount of political support from hopefully those person's supporters, and it shows how broad and deep the search was. So what I would expect in both cases would be a lot of confidentiality till you get down to two or three finalists, and then some super finalist list being released. That's what happened in 92 when the names of Al Gore and Lee Hamilton, the two finalists then, were both leaked to the public. In 2000, when Vice President Gore's three finalists, who were, interestingly enough, Senator Lieberman, Senator Kerry, and Senator Edwards, the last two being the ticket in 2004. Those were the three final candidates he looked at in 2000.
And would you ever go to somebody who's on that list and say, is it okay if we leak your name?
Well, you know, it's an elaborate dance. I mean, I think that generally somehow this happens and everyone denies that it ever happened. And so I don't think anyone will ask permission to leak, but you know, somehow it all kind of gets out there anyway.
We're talking with Ron Klain, the former chief of staff to Vice President Gore, instrumental in choosing the vice presidential candidate for the Democratic Party in the year 2000. Of course, NPR's political editor Ken Rudin was with us here in the Political Junkie segment at the Newseum here in Washington, D.C., and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another question from here in the audience.
Hi, my name's Andrew Bean. Mr. Klain, I was wondering, in 2000, how did the campaign deal with people who may be on the short list, who made public overtures about wanting to be on the vice presidential, wanting to be in the vice presidential slot?
Well, it's a great question. I think that generally the style is to feign a lack of interest. And I think people, you know, have one of these kind of come hither, go away kind of attitudes about it, which is they publicly disclaim any interest in the position, and meanwhile, often they are busy behind the scenes lobbying for consideration. You know, I think that what anyone who's running the search tries to do, in 2000, Warren Christopher ran the search for Vice President Gore, and I worked for Secretary Christopher on that. I think what they all try to do is try to very discreetly find out who's interested, try to move people through the process as discreetly as possible, as long as possible, to try to balance all that, and to keep the list as broad as possible for a long time. I think the important thing in the search is to recognize that until you get to the very end, you're not really sure which of these people is going to be exactly right. And so I think most campaigns try to keep a pretty broad list in play until you get to the very end. The most interesting one of these processes, I think, in modern times actually was what Governor Bush did in 2000. There was a very elaborate search process. The person in charge of that process was Dick Cheney, and the process ended with Dick Cheney being the choice, which, you know, it's hard for me to understand exactly how that all worked out, but it did. And so obviously it's a process that can have twists and turns all along the way.
Here's an email question from John. Your guest was instrumental in picking Joe Lieberman as the Democratic nominee for vice president. He also referred to the no surprises rule. Has he been surprised in subsequent years to learn that Lieberman is a de facto Republican?
Well, you know, I don't know if it violates the no surprises rule. I think it's more of a question of what's happened since then. I think at the time when Senator Lieberman was selected, he was well within the mainstream of the Democratic Party, and I think we all understood him to be. Certainly since then, he's moved considerably to the right. Vice President Gore has moved somewhat to the left, and the ideological gulf between the two men is about as wide as you can get. But I think really, as with many other things in this country, 9/11 and the war in Iraq have really polarized that. At the time, Joe Lieberman wasn't where he is today. At the time, he was a Democrat. At the time, he was pretty much a mainstream Democrat. And so I have been quite surprised by what's happened since then. But I don't think at the time we were somehow misled or misunderstood where Senator Lieberman's views were at that time.
And another email question, this one from Lucas in Lombard, Illinois. Do you think that with Dick Cheney greatly expanding the powers and reach of the vice president, the choice for VP has become more important?
Well, I think it's always been an important choice from the perspective of the potential president and from the perspective of governing the country. Vice President Cheney is certainly the most powerful vice president in history, but Vice President Gore before him was a very powerful vice president. And actually, people forget, but Walter Mondale was a very powerful and very influential vice president more than 30 years ago. So I do think it's a very, very important choice. As I mentioned earlier, it may not be a hugely politically significant choice. I think the idea that somehow these people deliver huge voting blocks or constituencies is overrated. But this person's going to be a partner in governing, a potential president, a highly influential advisor. And that's a very important pick.
Ron Klain, now, how'd you like the movie?
Well, you know, I think there are parts of the movie that were accurate, parts that weren't, parts I liked more, parts I liked less. What I did like about it was I thought it was great that the issues raised by the movie recount, the issues of voter disenfranchisement, of all the problems in our electoral system, were brought back before the country again. I think the more those issues are brought before the public, the more focus there is on those issues, the better for our country. We still have a very flawed electoral system, and it's a system that needs improvement.
Younger than Kevin Spacey, too. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks,
Ryan,
for having me.
Neil, I didn't see the movie. Who won?
We'll get back to you on that, Ken. Coming up, we'll talk about Washington's summer reading list, Scott McClellan's new memoir, and we'll talk with somebody, one of the few, who's actually read the book, plus David Folkenflik, about the media circus surrounding its subsequent publication in the newspapers. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.